Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Cinefix Top 100, our battlefield between good and evil, where the power of Christ compels us to watch 100 of the greatest movies of all time. I'm Clint Gage, and joining me as always, Cinefix's Chief of Head-Spinning Technologies, Alex Stedman. Alex, how you doing?
I was actually going to say that I'm ready for a head-spinning episode, so you're way ahead of me.
Can't wait. And we also have our pea soup enthusiast, Michael Calabro. Cal, what's up?
How's it going?
It's going, man. So as usual, here we are, possessed by Dan's algorithm that is working in conflict with our own personal beliefs, which really, I was thinking about it, and I feel like this movie is the most thematically relevant movie that we've covered so far where our relationship with Dan's algorithm is concerned, because like we searched our souls and our faith in our own sort of cinephileness to come up with our top 100 lists, and then Dan's science came charging in at it, and where in the twain do they meet? And then now that Dan's algorithm has just smushed it all together into one... Dan is the demon. Dan is the devil.
I was going to say, is Dan Pazuzu and we're all Marin?
It burns!
Dan, I feel like, producer Dan has an ancient statue of himself in the desert, I think, somewhere, is what I'm assuming at this point. But all that rambling nonsense to say, we're talking about The Exorcist this week, and I personally love this movie.
I'm with you. This is up there for me. I'm one of the people, I carry on the long tradition of having seen this movie way too young, and I can count on one hand the movies that genuinely scared the crap out of me, and The Exorcist is absolutely one of them.
So I'm a contrarian here. I think this is a good movie, but I am in no way in love with this movie. As a matter of fact, like, I am a bigger proponent of The Omen. I think The Omen is the better possession movie. I'm a big fan of that franchise, and I don't know. I only came to this movie when I was a teenager, and something about a disobedient child cursing in front of doctors never particularly scared me. I just thought that was like hilarious. You know?
I don't think the scary part.
Yeah, that's not where the scary factor of this movie lives and dies. I think
I don't know, man. But like when she's like just like, you know, stabbing herself with the crucifix and cursing, like children cursing is just hilarious. And you can have as many doors slam shut as you want. You could chill the set down to -20. You can like rock furniture, but like as long as there's like a little child cursing and an adult voice, I'm gonna laugh my ass off.
You're checked right out. As soon as that little kid with the growly voice, you can't take it seriously?
I'm engaged, but I can't take it. I can't do it. Like the thing about The Exorcist that's like good is just like, you know, like Reagan gets possessed and then it's up to like her mother to go to the scientific community to try and like get help to find out what's wrong with her daughter. But everybody realizes that something's fucked up with Reagan, and like they're all working in ironically good faith to save her, right? Before they have to turn to the priest. Like that is cool, and I definitely understand how that was like scary and weird in like 1973. But like the thing about The Omen that, in my opinion, what makes The Omen real scary is that like all of Gregory Peck's allies die, or like mysteriously like Final Destination get killed, and that movie culminates with like Gregory Peck, like basically the authorities, like society, barging into the church right about as Gregory Peck is trying to murder the spawn of Satan, and yet to them he is the bad guy.
Cal, did you get The Omen on the list? Now I'm curious. Like, is it on your on your list instead?
The Omen is on my list, but I like that. Like, that is the exorcism movie that is like the demon movie that I always gravitate to.
And I was gonna say it's not technically a possession movie. Yeah. The kid is actually the devil in that movie. But yeah. if it is on your list, I bet we'll you know, maybe Halloween. By the way, happy Halloween, guys.
Oh yeah, happy Halloween.
Maybe next year we can convince Dan we can do a not top 100 on The Omen and have this conversation. This exact conversation. We already have the footage.
I'm going to actually just go shoot it myself before Dan shoots me.
I know. Well, I'm gonna see if I can steer us back towards The Exorcist before we get too far down the road. But.
Amen.
God, defender of the human race.
So, The Exorcist, 1973, directed by William Friedkin, who I think has made some of my sneaky favorite movies. Friedkin is a guy that I feel like his movies, when I see them, I'm like, oh wow, that was so much better than I expected it to be. Written by William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel. Also, the novel was an enormous hit back in the day. But then starring Ellen Burstyn, Jason Miller, Linda Blair. I think the biggest name that's actually in this movie at the time would have been Max von Sydow.
Yeah,
but even that was like kind of in the artsy, you know, he was Ingmar Bergman's guy back then. And so it's a relatively unknown cast in what was also a relatively big budget movie for the day. I think Warner Brothers had a lot of faith, ironically, in this after the book was such a bestseller. But the book was such a big hit that Blatty actually got to be a producer on the movie.
He also
is a fascinating thing that does not happen anymore.
He also went on to direct some of the sequels, right? Like
he did. He did. Yeah, the third one. Yeah. I know at least.
So
yeah. And but you're not wrong about them having a lot of faith in it, ironically. But I don't think it started as expensive as it ended up. I mean, they just kept having to reshoot things, and people kept getting injured, which I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, it did not start that way.
Yeah, it was a long process, and then potentially cursed. If we can tease another thing that we'll end up talking about later, I feel like we've teased all of the things at this point. In terms of the cast though, it was made up of someone. Ellen Burstyn she'd been in TV. She was in The Last Picture Show. That was the other big thing that she'd done to that point. Linda Blair, obviously this was her first thing. They found her, they auditioned. It was one of those we auditioned 700 kids or something like that. And then Jason Miller he was a playwright. And your favorite guy, Cal. Go ahead.
Listen, he's a hometown hero, man. Like, he's from Scranton, Pennsylvania. He's probably the most famous actor we've got.
They call it Scranton.
What?
The Electric City.
Scranton.
What?
The Electric City.
You know, before The Office put Scranton on the map, every single person that you know in Scranton is A, seen The Exorcist, and you'd be like, did you know the priest is from Scranton?
You just grew up with people constantly did you hear the priest from Strand?
You know the priest from The Exorcist.
You know that guy.
He's Oscar nominated. The actual priest? Yeah. But anyway, I mean, let's just get into the pedigree of this. You mentioned already, we mentioned that Jason Miller was nominated for an Academy Award. Got nominated for 10. Best Picture, Director, Actress, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, Art Direction, Cinematography, Editing. Those were all nominations. And then it got wins for Best Sound. And Blatty got one for the best screenplay.
He took home the trophy for that.
But the movie, when it hit, it was a hit. It was kind of a phenomenon. Everything that I read about this and saw in some of the behind the scenes, Warner Brothers knew it was good. And then when it came out and people were passing out in the theater and stuff, they were like, oh, okay. And then it blew up from there.
Yeah, this is one of the first blockbusters, right? This is one of those movies where you just see people lined up down the block waiting to see this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where I wish I could just go back in time just so I could experience the actual zeitgeist around it.
Right.
Because I didn't believe it at first. But yeah, the people passing out, the people camping out, it's insane. And the Oscars are not insignificant because the Oscars were not given out nominations to genre fair. And honestly, I feel like they've kind of gone back on that in the years since. But yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah, they're sort of overcorrecting on some of it. But
they have.
It's the but this yeah, this one to be a horror film that gets nominated for all of these, much less Best Picture. That was something else in the 70s.
Although, what I did reading something that Blatty kind of like gave this, went on this big tirade about how it didn't win enough, even though Blatty himself had won. He was like, ugh. And I like kind of agree with him. I don't know what won Best Picture that year, but I can't imagine we talk about it more than The Exorcist.
Well, somebody looked that up while I talk about William Friedkin again.
I feel like we always,
Because he was coming off of winning an Academy Award for The French Connection. That was what he had previously done, and that was the movie that Blatty saw that got him this gig. Like, he was Blatty's choice, and they wanted, you know, the studio was talking about, you know, Kubrick and like much bigger names to direct this movie, but Blatty was like, nope, I saw French Connection, and Friedkin's my guy. But this window right here for Friedkin between French Connection, the Exorcist, and Sorcerer, like that's a three movie run that you can stack up there against a lot of people's three movies run. Like that's a good stretch.
Man.
By the way, The Sting won Best Picture.
Yeah, I was just gonna say the '70s were so fucking cool. Like the Sting beat The Exorcist for Best Picture, and Linda Blair lost to Tatum O'Neal in Paper Moon, which is also like an incredible.
Oh, wow. Like, which little kid is going to win this year? Yeah. That's crazy.
It's a wild year.
Yeah.
No, but you're not wrong, Clint. The French Connection with, like, but the thing that I find pretty interesting is that Blatty went to Friedkin because he was a documentary maker. Yeah. And a lot of The Exorcist comes across like as a documentary, which is what I think is so scary about it. It kind of looks like you're just watching like some detective's account of this terrible like possession.
Well, and that's what Blatty's approach was for the book too. Like he talked to, there was a priest that gave him homework when he was doing research on the book, and like he goes farther out of his way to kind of in the book anyway to like, there's a potential that it is fake. Like that it is not happening, and then things like, which is a thing that the movie never even thinks about doing. The movie's like, nope, this is real. But for a movie that the most iconic shot of the movie is a little girl's head spinning 360 degrees around, like it's like, oh no, this is a really grounded approach to the film, which is incredible. And that's, there are several moments in here and several things that I think are treated with such weight and such realism that, that's why this is so scary. Like, and I think it will probably end up having shades of that conversation this whole time about like, well, what's so scary about this? You know, cause Cal's an Omen guy. And then this is a very different movie in a lot of ways. So
it is
also, there's a lot of really smart and like, we'll get into it, like technical aspects of this, like things that are so easy to solve for now that they had to just like invent on the spot then, that it's just like a lot of ingenuity went into like the practical effects of this thing. And
that's that too, I think. And then those are the moments where I kind of flagged the idea. I was like, and this is why this movie is scary, because like the way that, you know, having her float above the bed, like you do that, you know, I could do that in Premiere, you know, easy enough. But then at the time in the early 70s, it's like, we got to figure out how to do this. And then audiences have to be like it's a real thing that's really happening on screen. And like, it's spookier that way. It just is. Like, you don't see the seams and you don't see the strings, and you can't just sit there and be like, oh yeah, that's CGI. So like, there's so much of that stuff, so much of that effort that went into the technical side of this movie, I think is part of it looking real and it being scarier. So,
and standing the test of time.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's a good version of practical effects instead of a cheap version or a bad version, early version of CGI. Yep. You know?
That the power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
Part of the story of this movie for me is all the different versions, right? From the book to the theatrical cut, and then to the director's cut. Like, I found one behind the scenes thing where Friedkin was telling a story about, there's a guy, this old impressionist painter, a guy named Pierre Bonnard. This is like a legend, apparently, who had, before he was dead, he had works hanging in the Louvre. And he got arrested one time at the Louvre for standing there with the paintbrush, like tweaking his painting. And the security guards were like, what are you doing? It's already in the Louvre. Like, why are you still trying to mess with this painting? which is kind of the dynamic that he and Blatty had over the years with like debating about what they should do with this movie and like how they should tweak it and who's reading it in which ways and how are they wrong. Like Blatty thinks that everybody's just wrong. He's like, I keep trying to explain what this movie's about, and nobody's like, no, I think it's about this. And I'm like, oops.
Well, I.
So it's funny that over the years, the two of them had so many different views on what should go into the movie and how it should read. It's just hilarious.
Well, I remember reading or watching an interview where Friedkin called Blatty a sore winner or something, because basically, mm-hmm. like, it was insane how incredibly successful the movie was. It was financially successful. It got Oscars and all that stuff. And yet Blatty was so mad. And the two didn't talk until, I think Friedkin said, until 2000 when they released the director.
It was years. Yeah. Yeah. They didn't speak for years, apparently, which is incredible. Yeah.
But they made like an objectively successful movie. It's just so crazy.
Yeah. So there's the theatrical version and the director's version. Do you guys have a preference?
The theatrical version.
I go back and forth.
What's weird is like the director's cut is oddly more of the writer's cut from what it seems like. Like the stuff that Blatty was mad that Friedkin cut out in the theatrical version, like all that stuff went in. There's interviews with Friedkin being like, I just respect him so much, I wanted to put that stuff back in, which is
And they were wrong. I mean, like it fundamentally changes the end of that movie, and I think the end of the theatrical cut ending is a way more profound and like emotionally felt ending versus the director's cut. And like that first scene that they put in when like she like they changed the first scene in which Reagan starts to show symptoms, and you know it's a chuckle fest for me, but I think it doesn't. adhere to the horror and like the mystery that they were going for that is more successfully reached in the theatrical cut.
I like certain things in the director's cut, and I like certain things that they cut out. I'm somewhere in between. Like I think the spider walk should be in there, and I'm sure we'll talk about the spider walk, but the alternate ending just kind of is so odd to me. I do like the scene where Marin and Karis are in the stairway, I think like mid exorcism, and they're kind of just like explaining the point of the movie, which Friedkin thought was a little, I think, on the nose. But I don't know, and I like seeing more Marin. We don't get a lot of Marin. I think he's a really cool character.
Yeah, well, let's get into Brilliant Moments so we can start talking about these things a little more specifically. So what do we want to talk about first? Cal, do you want to dive straight into your little kid profanity scene?
Yeah, I mean that first scene where it's just like.
So this is we're talking about the scene here where she brings Reagan into the doctor's office and they're doing all just the basic exams.
Yeah, it's just like the on the knee stuff and like you know just the typical stuff. But then it's just like also just like a very funny line where it's just like they're in the doctor's office after and he's like, you know, your daughter has quite the vocabulary. And then it's just like, well, what did she say? And he's just like, I don't feel comfortable saying. And it's just
I shouldn't say it in front of a lady.
Yeah, it's just I don't know. I just think that stuff is just so wonky and like it just really changes the dynamic of the movie. And like I also like empathize with this. Like when I was a child, there I got stung by a bee and I had an allergic reaction. And then like the doctor had to give me a shot, and I told him that if he was going to give me that shot, I would kick him in the nuts. So then like I just like very much empathize with this little girl here, and also why I just don't inherently see her as possessed because I hated doctors too as a child. And it's just like,
did you kick him in the nuts though?
No, but my mom had that very same conversation with the doctor where she was like, where did you hear the phrase kick him in the nuts? It's just like my cousin said it.
You tell me which one of your friends said that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that moment in towards the end of that scene where he finally says what Reagan said to him. And, you know, Chris is like,
like just I love no
weird little Ellen Burstyn giggle. Like, oh, that is kind of funny. Yeah. You know, it's those moments of I guess before this was in here, like we just see Reagan exhibiting the symptoms and then we move straight on to what's next. Like, we don't have to talk. This is basically a scene where we just saw a thing happen. Yeah, there it is. We just saw a thing happen, and then now there's two people talking about the thing that just happened.
Yeah.
Which is like, there's no type of scene that needs to be in a movie less, you know?
Yeah. I actually agree with you guys. I don't think we need this scene at all. The only thing I really like is Ellen Burstyn's little giggle. It's very humanizing.
Yeah. Right. And it, I mean, I guess in its defense, it does sort of, you know, it eases her transition into like really taking it seriously. Like, there's still room for her to be like, I know she's going to be fine, but you know, we'll figure this out. It's that level of, or that stage of trying to figure out what the hell's going on that she's in right now. It's not urgent yet, you know?
It's kind of to what, like, you know, kind of Blatty's original, it's kind of like the novel where he built up more of the scientific aspect of it and the, you know, kind of like you were saying, it's, this actually couldn't, like, maybe this isn't real. It's kind of a holdover of that, I feel.
Without this scene, we get to the party scene, which I know you're a fan of, Alex, and like we're going to talk about. Like, we get to that scene faster, and I just think that it does the same thing, but it just punches harder. And I don't necessarily think we needed to get eased into that moment a little more.
Well, and again, too, there's the difference of approach between Blatty and Friedkin, which I think is the story of this whole movie. You know, there's the idea that like we want to let people discover things for themselves, and we want to let people sort of apply whatever meaning that they bring into it. Like, this whole movie is a Rorschach test as far as Friedkin is concerned. But then Blatty wants to be like, no, but I mean, tell you, it's kind of a happy ending. Like, there's room for a happy ending here, guys. And Friedkin's like, I don't give a shit about that. Like, people can believe whatever they want to believe about it. Which I think is, you know, better myself.
There are two different approaches. Yeah,
they're two very different approaches. And you can see it in the theatrical cut versus the 2000 cut. Like, it's... What, 11 minutes difference?
Yeah, like 11 or 12. But it's very different.
11 or 12 minutes across three or four scenes is all it really is. Like, there's this scene, this conversation is a couple minutes long. There's, you know, a little bit more up front in Iraq. And then a little bit more on the end, couple things mixed in. There's not a ton of stuff happening in those 11 minutes, but it's a big change. It's a noticeable change.
It is.
I did also see where they were going to put more in, but they had like a bunch of work prints that they couldn't find the negatives for, and there was like, I think the director's cut could have ultimately been pretty bad based on, like, the director's cut is, I mean, we can have a preference for the theatrical cut or whatever if we want to, but like, I think there was an actual shot that the director's cut was going to be legitimately bad if they put all of this stuff back in, but they just couldn't find the sound for it, or they couldn't find the original. And it was stuff like them wandering around DC, like sightseeing and talking about.
Oh yeah, that scene is so unnecessary. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I wish I could Frankenstein my own director's cut, where I just take out like the DC scenes and even this scene, and just put in the spider walk and Marin and Karis on the stairwell, and that would be my perfect director's cut.
So we've talked about spider walk a couple of times. Let's dig into that just a little bit more. Cause the big reason, so this is a scene, she just finds out that, that her director is dead, had died in an accident. And the guy that tells her, as soon as he leaves, she turns around and here comes Reagan just spider walking down the stairs. And this was, they could see the wires.
Yeah.
Back in the day. And that was the big reason why they cut this. This wasn't cut for any ideological reasons, as far as I can tell. Like, this was just a technical, like, nah, we can see the scene. We can see the wires. And so it didn't make the theatrical cut. But, like, you know, 25 years later, it's easy to scrub those out. And now this is, to me, this is the scariest shot in the whole movie.
Easily.
Love this shot.
Easily.
Ugh.
Like, my original viewing of The Exorcist is really fuzzy because I was really young, but I feel like I originally saw the theatrical cut and didn't see the spider walk scene, because when I rewatched it a few years later, the spider walk scene was in there, and I just it just caught me so off guard, and I think I like literally screamed. It is so, and I think I read somewhere that in addition to the Wire issue, that I think Blatty thought it was like too much too soon.
They
like
sped,
it was too.
They sped it up too.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple of different things that they tried to make it work, I think. Because it also, there's an extended version of it where she's like has this really long tongue and she's like lizard kind of girl chasing yeah. her mom around a little bit, which was very hokey and weird. The blood coming out of her mouth thing was like an alternate version that they ended up cobbling the two shots together, I think, is what it seems like. But they made it work for the director's cut, and it's such a scary, unnatural thing to look at, you know? And I think at this point, there was some discussion I feel like I saw in one of the behind the scenes interviews. By the way, I spent all day listening to Blatty and Friedkin talk to each other. There are some fascinating behind the scenes commentaries where they're just kind of like chatting.
You could look into the behind the scenes at this movie forever, and I feel like you still wouldn't get it all. Like, there's just so much behind the scenes stuff for this damn movie.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was a conversation about, like, you know, the emotional sort of, it's sort of like a couple of different climaxes in a row, because you find out somebody's dead and you're like, all of these other things that are happening at this point in the movie, to then just layer this other thing on top of it, just felt like too much.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get that. Like, I think just the fear factor of it, and you're not ready for it. It completely catches you off guard. The next thing you know, like it's still pretty grounded up to this point. And then the next thing you know, there's a 13-year-old crawling backwards on a flight of stairs. It's the scariest yeah. thing.
The other thing that I do love about the way it's cut is it you know, we're screaming and there's blood coming out of her mouth and then it cuts straight to black.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It cuts straight to black and it stays there. For longer than you think. They do that a handful of times in the movie where something awful is happening and then it gets cut short into the next scene. And to me that really feels like a, just, oh my God. And then cut to black. To me, that really feels like he's making you stew in it a little bit, you know, like he presents you with these scary images. And then we hard cut away from before we have time to process what we're seeing, and we have to move on with the rest of our life. And so, like, to me, like that's an edit technique that puts us more in the shoes of what it's like for, you know, Alan Burstyn to be living through this. Or not Alan Burstyn's character, to be living through something like this, and just not knowing what's next, not knowing what's coming, but having that image of what just happened fresh in your mind is such a scary way to be for 2 hours. And it's edits like this that really drive that home.
Yeah. And I think especially where it comes in the movie, like you said, she just found out her director is dead. And I go back to that deleted scene that I really like, where Maron's essentially telling you the point of the movie. And he's saying something like, you know, the target isn't like, cause Karis is like, why this girl? And Maron's is like, it's not, Reagan is not the target. It's everyone in this house. Yeah. It's not the girl. It's everyone else's. And God, you just feel the weight from Ellen Burstyn. Like, she is already freaking out. And because, again, of this, like, kind of almost documentary style, it's really easy to empathize with her. And then, yeah, you just see her poor 13-year-old daughter coming down the stairs. Like, it's just, at that point, you just want to cry for her.
Yeah. It's tough.
The only thing I don't love is that the body double doesn't look terribly like Linda Blair, but that is a nitpick.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
What else? We skipped over the beginning, the opening the movie in Iraq with Father Marin on an archaeological dig. Which I think the only difference there is the director's cut opens with like this really kind of sleepy shot of the house before we cut away to Iraq.
I think you're right. I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on this opening scene because I can never figure out if I like it or not. I think where I land on it is that I think I like what it's trying to do, which is kind of set up this existential spiritual battle between Pazuzu, which by the way, hilarious demon name, and Marin. But it's way too long. Like, you should just cut it a little bit. It takes up way too much of the opening of the movie.
I agree. I mean, it's fun, though. I don't think it needs to be that long. Like, I just wish they did, like, the opening credits over it, right? Like, if it did double duty and you just, like, had, like, the casting and all that as he's just kind of, like, roaming around the streets of Iraq and, like, he finds the medallion and then it's just, like, The Exorcist. And then it goes into that weird, like, double exposure shot of him and the statue of what I assume is Pazuzu.
I do really love the sound design of this opening part though. Like, and I think that's sort of the double duty that it's doing, is kind of establishing some of these more sort of ancient type of sounds that we're going to be exposed to later, you know, and like the way that the hammering on the anvil is like the pace of the thing is cut to match that. And, you know, cutting from, you know, a guy, I think he's a guy's like a carpenter is working, and then match cutting that to a clock ticking, and all of those little things are so, so meticulous and they make the scene so interesting. I think that like, I could live in that scene for a little bit longer, to be honest. The weird thing is though, that it's not, you know, it's not Father Marin's movie, but we spend the first, 10 minutes of the movie with Father Marin. And then we go on something else. So it is strange in that regard. But I like the way that sequence is put together so much that I don't mind it at all.
It also does have some of the best shots of the movie, because you have that one where I think it's like a church and like the red sky behind it. It's beautiful. But that's a good point about you see Father Marin in the beginning and then you basically never see him. That's another thing that I go back and forth about. I'm like, do I like Father Marin as kind of this unseen, like, I don't know, spiritual hero who is like their secret weapon against fighting Pazuzu? Or do I wish we saw more of him? I really don't know. It is, but it's a weird structure. There's a lot of weird structural choices in this movie.
There's the idea that it sets up some type of eternal kind of struggle. That's what the movie's about, more so than it is about any one person or any one character or anything like that. Or, you know, it would be weird if we didn't meet him and then all of a sudden they're like, let's bring in the old guy. And then he just kind of shows up. I could see that. I could see that being the case now if it was made right now.
It's a good vibe scene, to your point, right? Like it has a cool vibe to it. It sets up the vibe and it like establishes, even like more or less silently, the credibility of a character that's going to have a profound impact on the plot in Act 3.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like this like priest just comes out of nowhere. It's like, we got to go get priest, and then it's just like some person you didn't meet from the first time. Like,
yeah, I do like the idea that like this is the scene where we meet the vibes.
Things are bad,
dude. Things are bad. Vibe scenes are great.
Vibe scenes are awesome.
Yeah,
absolutely. Can we also really quickly talk about, and this is kind of segue into some makeup discussion that I think we can have, but Max von Sydow was like 40.
Yeah, young man.
He was not an old guy. And Dick Smith, the guy that did the makeup on this movie, he had just done Brando's makeup on The Godfather. He would go on to do old Salieri's makeup. But
He went to go on to do Salieri's makeup in The Better Oppenheimer.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Amadeus, famously known as the better version of Oppenheimer.
That's what everyone calls it.
Everyone's always been calling it that since the '80s. but he was kind of a legend at this point. Already, like he was one of those guys that he was kind of one of the reasons why they finally made an Academy Award for hair and makeup. But the I got to go to over the summer when I was in LA, I got to go to a screening at the Academy Museum Theater, which is me totally name dropping an experience, I guess, whatever the word for that is. But the Rick Baker actually did the intro. He introduced the movie because this was Rick Baker's first kind of big budget job. Like he'd worked a little bit. And he was, but he was uncredited on this movie. And he told an incredible story about, first of all, like how he met Dick Smith is he was just a fan of his. And he like wrote letters back and forth and Dick Smith needed help on this movie. And he was like, hey, you want to come out and work with me? And they like worked with him in his basement on The Exorcist. And that was like one of his first big breaks. But they went through a lot of work to get the makeup right on Reagan. And then when they brought her on set, this is a story that Rick Baker told. When they brought her on set, he heard some grip say something like, oh, look, she's got her demon mask on. And Friedkin overheard him saying that and was like, oh, well, start over. Like, it's too masky. You got to start over. And so he had to go back to the drawing board and like redo Reagan's look as the demon, like, from scratch. And like Rick Baker said, it's so funny listening to Rick Baker tell this story about one of his idols. And he was so mad at Friedkin and Blatty both. He's like, what the fuck who do you think you are talking to Dick Smith like this? And of course, by the end, like they got it all right. And he was like, you know, and that was my lesson was like, sometimes directors know what they're talking about. But anyway, all that to say the makeup, including Max von Sydow's, you know, old man makeup, is really incredible. And the practical effects on this movie, I think again for like the early 70s, it's such an era of like ingenuity. Like you just had to figure stuff out on your own. Like there weren't any shortcuts to do it right. You know, from the makeup all the way to, you know, beds floating and, you know,
and if you couldn't,
wardrobes flying across the room.
And if you couldn't do it in camera, you didn't do it at all.
Yeah, you figure out something else.
And then you release the spider walk scene 25 years later. And it becomes one of the most... Later,
yeah. you take a swing and you blow it and you don't put it in the movie until you know the technology shows back up. But I do really like... I mean, it's one of those... this is the era of like the old tricks are the best tricks, you know? Like they built the stage up off the ground and they just had pulley systems underneath the floor that was like pulling stuff all over. And they were... you know, shooting stuff across the room with just a big fan. And they just kind of constructed the number of in all these behind the scenes things, the number of times somebody said like, yeah. And then the grips just figured it out.
Well,
grips are the smartest people on the planet. Yeah. I love grips so much.
And like, you look at like the behind the scenes footage of like the bed shaking, for example, and it's just a bunch of dudes working their asses off. Like they're just like shaking it up and down. It's like, blood, sweat and tears. And it wasn't easy for the actors too. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but like the room being that cold because they couldn't generate frost breath. Like,
yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Cause that's kind of my bump in the lamp for this movie, I think, is how cold they made that room. So it was all born out of, I want to see their breath.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Friedkin wanted to see all the characters' breath. And to do that, like, you need it to be cold, obviously, but you also need moisture in the air. And the air conditioner was also sort of dehumidifying the room. So they had to go even colder to, like, I mean, some people were talking about, like, it was negative 20 or negative 30 degrees in that room when they would walk in. And they were all in these, like, Arctic suits. And poor Linda Blair was just, like, in her pajamas the whole time. But they made it literally, it was below freezing in that room.
And they could only do a couple of takes before it got too hot. And it's just like, you know, that's just, that scene just reminds me of, like, that, like, Calculon line in Futurama where he's like, amateurs do two takes, I do one. And it's like they went in there, they hit their marks right before it got warm, and then they, like, bounced out and had to wait for it to get cold again. And they did it, like, in a very, very efficient manner. And it's wild to do that not only with, like, seasoned and trained actors, but also, like, young actors as well. Like, the fact that, like, Linda Blair is, like, killing it in this scene and, like, was able to do it under the, like, limitations of few takes. It's incredible.
Yeah, and yeah.
I mean, she was freezing and only had one take to get it right.
Can you imagine just trying to hit your mark while you're just freezing?
No, and she's 13. Yeah. And I remember seeing an interview where she was like, I can talk about this movie forever, and no, you still won't get how hard it was for me. The fact that she had to be in this cold, and she actually, like, her contact, she had to wear eye numbing cream or something crazy. And then, yeah, like you said, Cal, she had to then hit her mark. Like, it's insane.
Well, and apparently she still hates the cold. apparently it was traumatic enough to where she just doesn't like the cold.
This human being, made in your image and likeness, strike terror, Lord, into the beast, now laying waste your image. Let your mighty hand cast him out of your servant, Reagan Therese McNeil.
Since we're talking about, like, difficult conditions, we might as well spin back a little bit to talk about some of the stuff that Blatty did. Friedkin did on set. Like, he would fire guns around set to get, and, like, the things that he did to get performances out of people. This is another thing that's very of that era, you know, because you hear all these stories about, Jason Miller told one to where, like, there's the scene where he's sitting there very, very focused on listening to this tape recorder, and then the phone rings and he jumps and it scares him. The way that he got that shot is Friedkin fired a shotgun, like, right behind him. And, like, that was the noise that made him jump. And it's just Friedkin firing guns on set. And everybody, you know, there I saw another story where Von Sydow showed it. Max would show up on set today and he would talk to the first AD or something. He'd be like, where are the guns hidden today? And he's like, well, there's a .45 behind the camera and then the shotgun is over there behind that wall. And he's like, all right, thank you. And that was just, like, part of his process was, like, when can I expect Friedkin to pull a gun on me today? Like, it was so bizarre. But then everybody would tell these stories. And they would all end with, like, but, you know, I love him. Like, what a
Billy's
like, what
a great guy.
Billy's a great guy. And he was like, no, but he, like, open-handed slapped you in front of the crew so that your hand would be shaking in that scene. Like, that, what, come on, man. Like,
well, I remember I think it was Jason Miller say something about along the lines of that gun shooting scene where he was like, you know, I can act, right? Like, I can just do the acting. And Ellen Burstyn said something similar with the scene that broke her. What was it, like, broke her rib cage with the harness when she was, like, pulled back?
It was like her tailbone or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And they had to, like, not shoot for a few days. And I remember reading somewhere that was the harness was already tight, and she asked for it to be looser, and Friedkin was like, no.
Well, yeah, there's another story about Linda Blair when she's, like, flopping back and forth on the bed when the psychologists first show up. Like, that, she was tied into a harness, and that, like, got too loose, and that, like, broke one of her vertebrae or something, and she got scoliosis for years or something.
Yeah, like, no, she has, like,
the
serious
people were
health,
getting hurt and telling, and there's also these stories, too, about, like, and this is, again, it's from this era of filmmaking where, like, you know, Ellen Burstyn said, he's pulling the rope too hard and I'm going to get hurt. And then Friedkin would say, like, okay, I hear you. And then she would turn around and she could even kind of tell that he was, like, given the stunt guy, like, it was like, go ahead, pull it harder this time. And then they did, and it hurt her. And she's like, they use that shot in the movie. Like, there's no compunction about, like, you know, putting your cast in danger, and then whatever happens on camera, like, we're going to use it. It's going to be in the film. And it's like, yep, he's a maniac, but I love him.
Well, that's like, it's you're no, you're so right click because they like still don't say anything bad about him in particular. They're like, yeah, no, he knew bizarre. What he was doing. Yeah. But this is one of those movies, I think, too, where knowing the behind the scenes really like kind of elevates the viewing experience, because the fact that I watched this scene and know that Ellen Burstyn really just broke her, yeah, like broke her vertebrae or whatever, it's like, oh, it makes it so much, it just hurts so much more.
Yeah. Ugh. I don't know. What else we got? What else do we want to talk about?
I mean, the scene we were just talking about is just such a wild one. And I think when I think about this movie with the crucifix and like masturbating with it, like that's what this is like after the spider walk. This is kind of what I think about. And I think it's just because it's so jarring and the effect with the hand that we just saw. But it's also like where it starts to get really, really uncomfortable with the whole like, F me. Like, it's this weird, yeah, weird mix of religion, family, and sex. And I think that is what makes this movie so horrifying. It's all these societal things that we don't want to mix, and all of a sudden we're mixing them very suddenly in a very scary way. And I think that's what really sticks with me when I think about The Exorcist.
Well, and this scene in particular, too, is where this, you know, science is starting to fail.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they haven't found anything like wrong with her and so far. But then the doctors being here and seeing this is when like modern science is failing. I mean, there's nothing that modern science can do to help this girl. And like that in and of itself is also scary for, you know, I mean, it's scary to this day, but I can imagine in the 70s it was worse somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny, too, because like I think later in the movie when Karis meets her for the first time, even he's like trying to be skeptical. And that's when she's full like possession, has lesions on her face,
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. It's where it's like, all right, guys, like, let's give it up. Maybe let's bring in the big guns, some priests.
Those priest big guns. I mean, the other... So, I mean, there's the other thing that I've already made one joke about it today, but the vomit. Man, that big vomit. To start with, it was, it's a cool effect. It's a cool makeup effect that they actually have it looking like it's spraying out of her mouth. There's a cool little rig that gets sort of hidden under her cheeks that kind of hides the hose back there, and it gets pumped out. You know, it's a sort of one of those things that it's a simple, kind of a simple deal that takes really good craftsmanship to do right. But the other incredible thing about this scene is that he was not supposed to get hit in the face with this.
Nah. And you know what,
and
you
so
know?
that's another like real reaction of.
Do you see in like the behind the scenes stuff, it's like they had like those like cardboard cutouts that are like the like police, like it looked like, yeah, those police, you know, like training where you shoot the guns at,
yeah,
the it was range.
Like gun range targets,
yeah, yeah, right. And it's like the silhouette of the man, and like they're using it to like, you know, basically just like do like the artillery targeting of the goop. So it like, here's where Jason Miller is going to stand. They, yeah, have all of these targets, and like the pea soup hits in the chest. And then on the day, right in the face.
Well, it also apparently had something to do with it being so cold, is because they were, you know, they were doing the setup, and then of course they had to tweak the lighting or they had to do something. And so the guy was all ready to go with his like pea soup and oatmeal formula. And he was sitting there thinking, like, I think it's probably gotten a little too cold.
It got jacked up,
so it's going to be heavier when it, yeah, comes out. So he aimed a little higher, and he gave it a little more gas, and it shot straight in the face. Well, and apparently, he was real mad.
Well, I mean, you think he's like so shooting a gun in his ear? You know, he's getting like, yeah, pea soup shot in his face. Like, he's just having a rough day.
But that's what I love about Jason Miller's reaction in the scene, because like you said, he does look pissed. Like, he kind of like wipes it off his face and then like,
yeah,
angrily flicks his hand. He's like, god damn it, Billy, again, you know I can act, right? I'm an actor.
But I was just thinking about this scene, and like, if it just hits him in the chest and he's like, like, I don't care about that scene. But him getting hit full in the face and it's in his mouth and like, oh, God.
It's so gross. And I think that's another thing. Like, when we're talking about, like, why this movie is so scary to me, I think a lot of it is just because it's so gross. Like, not to get too gross, but, like, you got to think about how that room smells or something. It's just, like, nasty.
Well, it probably didn't smell that bad until they let it warm up.
I mean, they
that's true. The cold helps.
They're also clearly, like, she puked a lot because they're like, they, you know, they needed to protect the furniture. They wrap it all down. They like baby protect it. So it's like all wrapped in blankets. And then it looks like newspaper like they do to have like the cover, the finish. And it's so she could do whatever she wants in there. Easy cleanup.
But I do love this scene in general, too, because, like, that's where you get this little dynamic between Karis and Pazuzu, and also where you see, like, Pazuzu's weird sense of humor with the whole, like, your mother's not in right now, but leave a message, which I think they parodied in Scary Movie, which I always think about. But, like, also, I'm curious to get your guys' thought when he sprinkles the holy water on her, but it's not actually holy water, but she's freaking out anyway. I always go back and forth about what that means. I don't know if she was just trying to fake him out, Pazuzu. Like, what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, it feels like it's part of that cat and mouse kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, like I think Pazuzu is just, you know, I'm sure there's some amount of like, I'm gonna let him think he's winning, kind of like I could see that happening in Pazuzu's sort of motives, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not it's, I don't think there's any sort of tangible, like, ooh, maybe it was all a dream kind of impact on the story. Like, I think it's probably just Pazuzu being a jerk.
Yeah. Pazuzu's a brat, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. he's a little demon. Cal, you mentioned something earlier, I think at the top of the show about the, or maybe this was earlier today. I can't remember anymore, but to get back into the idea that grips are the smartest people on the planet, and how they didn't have a Steadicam back in the day, but they still wanted a shot that tracked people upstairs, going upstairs.
Right? Yeah, so that it's crazy to me that we think it's like, and the Steadicam is what, 10 years removed from this, because like Kubrick would be using it a lot in The Shining seven years from then.
Yeah,
more or less, right? So In order for Friedkin to get continuous shots from the ground floor up the stairs to the second floor, they had to build a rig, and it's functionally a swing that they put the cameraman in, and then like there's grips behind the scenes like pulling him up, and then there's grips, and then there's like some camera people behind the swing, you know, directing it up the stairs, so it's like it's free floating, and that's how it moves around. And it's just this like whole wire contraption that they had above the set in order to do these complex tracking shots up the stairs. And it's wild to think about how bespoke of a solution needed to be figured out in order to do something as simple as having a continuous shot up a flight of stairs.
And then, I feel like we run into those two different kind of solutions. You talk about a bespoke solution for this. Like, this is, we have one shot that we need to get in the can here, and so we're going to do this elaborate pulley system to make it happen. The other side of that coin is like somebody invents the Dijkstra Flex, right? Like, or somebody invents a computer that can do it, or you know, something like that. I feel like it's like, here's a thing that we can use on every movie from now on.
Yeah.
Or like a bunch of really smart guys that can build stuff.
Yeah, you got 2 days. Oh, no, to
figure
this out.
I can get you up the stairs smooth.
Hang on. Just give me a half day. I'll get you up there. Because they did the same thing with the shot of the psychiatrist who gets his balls grabbed. Which is a great shot. All of those, like,
it's a great shot.
Yeah, where the camera stays on him, and it's the background and like the peripheral stuff that moves. Awesome. Yeah,
it's one of those like Requiem for a Dream shots. Mm-hmm. Except it was the first version of that. Yeah. And what it was like they built basically just a stand for the guy. It's all just plywood. Like it's all 2x4s and plywood. And he literally had to climb up and stand in this thing that the camera was attached to. And just three or four guys just kind of like lowered him to the ground. And he was just like, but it's just, you know, you give the guys a problem and then you go away and tomorrow they've got it figured out. Like it's such a fun, filmmaking gets to be really like heady and, you know, let's talk about film and what it means and all this stuff. But so much of filmmaking for me, which that part's great. I love doing that. But I love revisiting these old movies to just see like how they did stuff. It's a puzzle, you know, like, I mean, it's just how they addressed problems.
And there's no,
it was so practical. And so there was no sort of like headiness about it. It's like, yeah. I got to get from A to B and logistically, how are we going to do it?
Yeah.
And it's incredible. I love that.
Even with the, like when they were suspending her, right? Like they were talking about how they had to paint the wires like different shades, because if you painted it all white, it would stand out on a black background. If you painted it all dark, it would stand out on a light background. But if you mix the shades like a polka dot, I think they said, it'll blend better because the eye can't distinguish it. It's
well, that is shit like that is subtly the most, like, I wouldn't say it's the most impressive part, but whenever I think about it, I'm like, who thinks about that? Like, who is smart enough to actually come up with that? Because, like, when you watch it, you genuinely don't understand how it was made without special effects. But, like, no, it was just basic, like, eye trickery. It's incredible.
Well, and also, like, this is a small movie, you know? Like, it's a very contained movie, and it's not one that you think of when you... You know, it's not one that immediately springs to mind when you think of like really ingenious practical effects. You know, like you think about The Thing and how, you know, people worked for 2 years to get the little head thing to do just right. And you think of all of those things that are like very practical effects, but like just a wardrobe moving from one side of the room to the other and doors slamming by themselves. And like every little thing that they did in this movie, adds up to a ton of work. Like there is a ton of effects and really, really good effects that hold up to the point where we don't even think that they're in there. You know, like it's not an effects heavy movie. There's some good makeup that jumps out, obviously, on Linda Blair. I assumed Max von Sydow was 75 years old since 1963, you know, like because of this movie. But yeah, all of the practical effects that are in there and just completely invisible are so cool.
Well, and the other thing about that but too it also, is it kind of goes to what we were talking about Friedkin just putting his actors through it, because it's one of those things where you know that when you're in that final exorcism scene, you know that Max von Sydow and Jason Miller are actually seeing that like in front of them. It certainly adds to it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as much as you hear about people complaining about being in front of a green screen and acting with a tennis ball,
right?
It's just like, nope, I got that pea soup shit in my mouth,
and I was pissed about it,
and a gun, and a gun shot in my ear,
because I'm of two minds of it. It's like that damn well better if you hurt me because of this, that better be in the movie.
Yep.
But then also, I'm like, how dare you?
Well, also, it is
exactly
the, it
which
is
the- that's.
The fact that Ellen Burstyn was like, it's a little tight. And he was like, make it tighter. Like,
come on. Make it tighter.
Please, stop. Make it stop. It's burning. It's burning.
Do something, doctor. Please help her.
I also want to talk about, I mean, we got to talk about the head turn also.
Yes.
Which, you know, again, I think now... You know, it's easy to think, it's like, yeah, well, they made a dummy and they put little robot parts so it, you know, they can move the eyes and everything. And I listened to one guy that said that they put the dummy in a cab and had it ride around Manhattan at one point just for fun, which I think is wonderful. But then so it's they were about to shoot it. And again, because of the cold, this is the bumping the lamp thing, the thing that continues to make the rest of their job harder. Like, they realized that there was no breath coming out of the dummy. And so then they were just like, oh, well, we got to fix that. And then so they give it to the special effects guy, and he figures out how to get breath to come out of the dummy also. And then now the dummy can turn its head and move its eyes, and it's breathing, and it's like, oh, God, that's terrifying. And it looks...
Amazing.
So I think it still looks good. Like it's a little bit wooden, and you can see, you know, that it's not right, quite right. But I'll take that over a CGI version of that any day.
But that, for I can't quite put my finger on it, but that's why it's so scary. The fact that it doesn't look quite right. It shouldn't look right. It's a little girl whose head is turning all the way around.
It's not supposed to look natural.
No, it's supposed to look really weird and jarring.
Yeah.
It's so good.
No.
There's a reason why that shot holds up too, right? It's just so jarring and everything looks so great. And it's just like done in the two shot, right? So it's like the close up on her, then it cuts as it's like turning around and you get it in the wide, then it cuts to the reaction and then back to her. So it's just on, to your point, like we talked a lot about it in T2 where they hold the shot just long enough so you can't show the seam, so you don't see the seams. And this is like the peak of them really starting to like find that groove and do it really, really well.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the way that they escalate the use of these things too is pretty good. But like, and again, this is another scene that ends on like a pretty distinct cut, and then we're out to the peaceful street. You know, that's like, that's the way that the movie's cut right there. And just having to sit there and live with what you just saw for a beat is really ingenious editing. But the other thing about that scene, the one that I want to talk about too, is there's another guy involved in this, Gonzalo Gavira, the sound designer, who was Jodorowsky's guy. Like he was working on El Topo when Friedkin saw the work and was like, I want him. So he did El Topo, he did Holy Mountain. And so that's why some of these sound design in this movie is downright trippy. And apparently the sound of the head twisting was the guy, apparently this Gavira was just in the, just had in front of a mic with no shoes on and his pant legs rolled up and he was just grabbing stuff and making sound. He found somebody's wallet. It was just some dude's, it was a leather wallet that somebody had in the room and he just like twisted it in front of the mic and that's the sound of the neck spinning, which is awesome.
God, cool. That's so, and I will say one thing that kind of surprised me when I was like kind of just looking at interviews and stuff. Friedkin says apparently the best way to experience the sound, actually he says the best way to experience The Exorcist in general is the Blu-ray. And he was saying that he was watching the Blu-ray and like hearing sounds that like he didn't even know was in there. So now I kind of have to go back to the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I wonder if they remixed it without him and added stuff in.
That's what I was thinking too.
Never heard it before.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the other thing that's so crazy about these effects is that they all have, like, this all happens in one room. And I think that's kind of why you don't think about it, like you were saying, Clint. You don't think about it as one of the most ingenious, like, movies for practical effects because it's so contained. But, like, 99% of what we've talked about happens in that one room. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a small movie.
It's a small movie.
Is there anything else we missed that we need to talk about before we move out of brilliant moments? I mean, I feel like
do we want to talk about the ending and how the ending is subtly different? Because like that, I think that's like of all the cardinal sins of all like all the mortal sins of the director's cut. I think it's the ending that is the one that is most profoundly changed, and I think it has a more than subtle effect on how the movie is should be perceived by audiences. So
the theatrical cut ends with Father Dyer looking down the stairs. This is Karis's friend, Father Dyer, played by an actual priest.
Yeah.
Looking down the steps, and then he just kind of turns and walks away. And that's the end of the movie. Then the director's cut has this whole other scene with Father Dyer and the cop, Kinderman.
It's not only that, in the theatrical cut, there's a scene at the end where the priest gives her the Karis's medallion, or not Karis's medallion, but the medallion, and she like accepts it and like goes on with her life, whereas in the director's cut she gives it back. And there's a way to read that where she's accepting faith, because like this whole movie is kind of about this like secular woman just refusing to come to terms with the fact that her child is possessed by a higher power that can't be explained by science. It can only be explained through faith. And by accepting the medallion at the end, she understands that faith has to be a part of her life moving forward. So it's supposed to symbolize like the internal change and the importance of the newfound importance of faith in her life versus in the other one, it's just like, okay, yeah, no, you keep this for your friend. I'm leaving Washington, D.C. I'm done here. You know, yeah. I've learned nothing, but I'm very grateful that my child is not.
I'm just glad to be done with this.
And I think that's like,
I mean, that's
because like, I like that because it's kind of, it kind of leverages that same moment, just like in Die Hard, where like it came to me later in life in Die Hard that Holly's watch is so meaningful to the theme of Die Hard and like, you know, the yuppie culture and the rampant capitalism of like the Reagan 80s and stuff like that. And I never put two and two together back in like when I was a child. And then I'm just like, oh, the watch. Yeah. How profoundly relevant. And then to see a similar totem emblematic like thing in The Exorcist also carry that kind of meaning. It's like, yeah, no, this definitely changes the vibe and takeaway of the movie.
There's another great discussion between Blatty and Friedkin about like Blatty wanted there to be some hope at the end. He didn't want it to be a completely downer of an ending. Like he wanted it to be, how did he put it? He's like, God's in heaven and everything's right with the world, you know, by the time that they end. And that's part of what that conversation between Dyer and Kinderman, the detective, was about. It's like, here's that sacrifice that Karis made, you know, isn't lost to time. Like there's still like, here's his impact living, you know, beyond him in the relationship between this other priest and the cop and, you know, the whole thing about, you like movies? I love going to see the pictures and all of that stuff. Like everything is just, there's a reset and that, you know, we're still in a good place. Like the earth is not, we're not totally f***ed here, guys. I know we just put you through the ringer watching this movie, but everything's going to be okay. I promise. Like, That is Blatty's ending. Like that's the one that he wanted to do. And Friedkin, again, like Friedkin wanted people to come by them, you know, themselves. Like, I don't want to tell people how to feel about this. People are going to feel how they want to feel about it. And that's great. That's part of the deal.
To your point, Clint, about what he was saying about how he, Blatty, saw it as kind of like Karis living on, I found was a real, because that's not what I got from it. But hearing him say that, I was like, kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of nice, I guess, because obviously like Karis is such a tragic character. He ends up giving his life for this little girl that he doesn't know, and but I still think it would have been really freaking weird to leave it in. Like, I get it, but
yeah,
take it up.
Well, there's also the idea of like, I've gotten everything that I think I need out of The Exorcist at that point. It feels like sort of feet dragging on your way out the door. Like, I didn't necessarily need that. Like, the detective, I feel like, was like, he was just kind of incidental to the plot for the most part. Although the scene where he asks for Ellen Burstyn's autograph is hilarious to me. Yeah. The fact that he's a film fan and knows her work and is like, it's for my daughter. And what's her name? It's, like, it's for me. Like, that was such a funny little thing, especially to put her through that. Like, with everything that we know is going on upstairs, like, to put her through that awkwardness is such an uncomfortable scene. But yeah, I certainly didn't need that at the end. I see the idea of it being a kind of happier ending and, you know, leave the theater with a little hope, but I don't think that's the point of this movie.
No, it also doesn't erase what we just went through for 2 hours. We're still pretty traumatized from it. I actually am charmed by Kinderman. I kind of think he's like an underrated player in the movie, but it's not because of the plot. I just think, I think I'm just weirdly endeared by the fact that he's there and he has this kind of very distinct personality and he likes to watch movies and critique them. And like, I don't know why you're here, but I'm not mad about it.
Yeah, I mean, if he's gone from the movie completely, you can lift him straight out. Like, you can. You know, I like, there's an added layer of stress for the sort of the. I guess it would be weird if the cops never asked about the dead body. You know, but like ultimately, like that's kind of a. You could skate past that on like movie logic. You don't necessarily need. You could narratively, you could lift him straight out. I am glad that he's there. I don't think that him being integral to the ending changes the movie to me. I don't think I need him there. But the fact that he's there, you know, during the exorcism and is running into the room at that, in that last scene, and to sort of witness that, like, I think that does add some more of the sort of the establishment, be it science or be it, you know, the law enforcement or whoever, has no idea how to handle this. Like, mm-hmm. showing that it is completely out of their hands is like, that's what he's for more than anything, I think. But okay. Well, I tell you what, we're running out of time, so let's move on to movie lists. Is there any other brilliant moments that you guys want to flag before we hustle on?
I think Karis's dream is interesting. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's something that I feel like I always forget about. But when I rewatch it, I'm like, ooh, that's creepy.
It is some real quality, like late 60s, early 70s montage.
Yeah.
Like there's some good dream sequence montages.
And for some reason, any back in those days. Movie that's just like a quick flash of something scary, because you just briefly get like Pazuzu's face. I'm like, oh, it's just.
That's another thing that's in the director's cut. There's, mm-hmm. you know, the Pazuzu's face in the background of a couple of those scenes got tacked on in the director's cut, which is another reason. It's like, I feel, you know, I think Friedkin was kind of right in that you don't want to explain too much in this movie. Like, you don't want to serve everything up on a platter. You know, mm-hmm. you want to. Audience needs to do a little bit of work, but anyway, I'm team theatrical, except for the spider walk.
Okay. So I want the spider walk, the conversation between Marin and Karis. Uh-huh. And I like the little flashes of Pazuzu just because they scare me. Okay. That is what I will take from the extended cut.
We can't. Okay.
In our a la carte exorcists.
Yes. And my Frankenstein exorcist, cut. Yeah.
But assuming he didn't have a Frankenstein exorcist, if you only had to choose one cut. Because I mean we can't pick the scenes we want. Like, each have their pros and cons. And when push comes down to shove, you have to pick A or B. What one is it?
I gotta go extended just because of the spider walk. I feel like just because of the spider have,
walk. It's that important.
It's that important. Like, that is like the scariest scene. I have to go extended just for the spider walk. If those are my options, if I can't a la carte it.
But it profoundly changes the meaning, like the takeaways of the film.
Spider walk, baby.
And spider walk all the way. All right. I'm theatrical cut. I love the spider walk. I think it's a really cool shot. And I'm like, you know, I appreciate that he George Lucas something in the good way into his film like 30 years later. But I don't think The Exorcist was a classic before that shot was ever in the film. And I don't think we should change. I don't think changing like significant thematic and narrative elements is worth adding the one cool shot in the movie that had plenty of cool shots beforehand.
It's such a strange conversation to me, though, because the director's cut was the one I saw first. And so thinking about that, like, I had to hunt down the theatrical cut to see it. And so, like, thinking about the changes, it sort of goes in reverse for me. Like, and particularly because, like, I mean, as I said earlier, like, I think that the director's cut was more of a writer's cut than any. I think that the theatrical version is the director's cut in this instance. But I'm team theatrical. I just keep going back to that story that Friedkin told about the painter getting arrested in the Louvre for working on his own painting. It's just like, cut it out. It's already in the Louvre. Yeah. Like, this is good. You had it. You got a winner. So cut it out.
I love the spider walk that much.
All right. Okay. Fair enough.
But totally fair.
I don't think so. The ending is very weird. The extended ending. Like I said earlier, I don't think it erases like the rest of the movie. I don't think it completely goes back on everything they were saying. I think it's weird, but.
Doesn't having the extra conversation with Dyer and Kinderman.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it ruins the movie. I think it's odd.
It doesn't. I don't know that it ruins the movie. It does change some things. I think pacing wise, it also, like, I need to be out of this movie by then. I don't need a whole other conversation just to get a cheeky I've already seen it. Like,
to be fair, I don't think that the director's cut ruins the movie in any capacity. I just think that the theatrical cut is tighter, and I think it has a sharper ending. So I do think it's superior. I don't think that the director's cut ruins it by any means.
I agree that it's way tighter. Yeah.
Goodbye, Father.
Goodbye.
I'll call you.
All right, movie lists. There we have covered The Exorcist a bit, a fair bit over the years. There's a What's the Difference that's up right now. That just went live. That's a brand new one. Best Movie Monsters. Pazuzu was on Best Movie Monsters because we broke it down based on the type of fear that the monsters instill. And those were our different 10 categories. And this one was the fear of being possessed, frankly, fear of something else taking over us. You know, it's sort of that was in the category with like zombies and stuff like that, too. Sort of becoming not yourself. Then Scariest Movie Moments. We talked about The Spider Walk, actually. That's how scary it is. We went with a director's cut scene for Scariest Movie Moments. And then it also got a shout out in our horror tropes movie list, because you can only do so many top 10 horror movies. We had to start doing horror tropes and scary moments. And
do you remember what trope it was particularly? I'm curious.
Because we didn't really, it was the, what was it? Because we didn't really have picks for that. Our picks were like broader tropes, and we used a lot of different examples for this. So I think it was, in the supernatural. It was possession. I think it was, it was probably something along those lines. Or just super religion, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Time to revisit that list, apparently. is there anything else that that this belongs on?
I feel like top 10
vomits?
Child performances?
Yep.
I mean,
right up there with fellow nominee Tatum O'Neill.
Yeah. I can't believe I didn't know she lost to Tatum O'Neill. That's a wild year.
Yeah, it's incredible that one child nominee lost to another.
Yeah.
I gotta revisit horror movies in general, because we did a top 5 horror movies, and we did it because horror movies are like Mount Rushmore is pretty well ensconced in horror, more so than I think most other genres. And so we did like replacements for some of those movies, and The Exorcist kind of didn't make that weird cut. But
let me ask you, this: is this your favorite freaking movie?
It's mine.
Definitely not mine, but
I know you. Well, you like a crime movie, so I imagine yours is The French Connection.
I think this is like 4 for me.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean,
to live and die in L.A. is awesome.
Yeah,
that movie's pretty great.
So is Cruising. So is Sorcerer. So is Sorcerer, and like so is The French Connection. Like all these movies are like awesome.
Well, I'm curious now, Cal. Do you have a Friedkin on your list that isn't The Exorcist?
I have.
I mean, spoilers, French, I guess, but
I have French Connection.
Yeah, yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, I know.
Seems like you're trying to pull back some curtains here, Alex.
I like to crack the code.
Yeah, it would be higher than 4th for me. I really enjoy this movie, but I mean, the French Connection and Sorcerer is one of those. I think I said it up top. Sorcerer is one of those movies that really snuck up on me when I finally got around to seeing it, because I had seen Wages of Fear and I knew it was a remake, and I just never I had never gotten around to it until fairly recently, and that was one where I was like, "Oh, this is good."
Like, I haven't seen Sorcerer. I might have to watch it tonight.
Yeah. It's Roy Scheider. I'm not looking forward to it. And it's very good. So it's up there for me. I mean, in terms of like top 10 freaking movies, I guess, if that's what you were getting at, for sure. But I would put, I mean, Sorcerer is good, and Cruising is good. I would put those below The Exorcist, though. French Connection, To Live and Die in L.A., and Exorcist are all kind of like 1A and 1B, you know?
Yeah.
I do really enjoy The French Connection, but it's, Exorcist number 1 for me. Easy.
There you go. All right. Let's torf. What are some things you didn't know? We've not done a things you didn't know about The Exorcist, so.
This might be tricky because I feel like we all know a lot about it, but.
Well, it seems like we all spent yesterday and today watching the same behind the scenes videos. So we can probably, I bet we're going to cruise through these and get a bunch of them right.
No, there were a lot of times where like you were saying something, Clint, and I was like, oh yeah, I watched that interview
too. Ooh, you gotta delete that. Yep.
We looked at the same scenes.
Yep.
same notes. Okay, so I'll try to trick you guys anyway. So this Torf has some buildup, so I will read you the background and then tell you when it's true or false time.
This already sounds like it's a false.
Okay, several scenes of The Exorcist were filmed on the Georgetown campus. Most famously, a scene in which the character Father Damien Karras falls down a flight of stairs was shot there. This next part, true or false? This staircase was nicknamed the Exorcist Steps by the horror community, but before the Exorcist Association, these stairs were called the Hitchcock Steps after their use in an earlier Hitchcock film. True or false?
So they were renamed the Exorcist Steps from the Hitchcock Steps?
Yeah. And they were
used to be called the Hitchcock Steps, and then after the Exorcist. Okay.
Yeah, they were called the Hitchcock Steps because Hitchcock used them.
False.
I'm going to go true. But I don't know. You know what? I am going to go false. I don't think Hitchcock liked to shoot on location a lot.
It's false. It's false. Yep.
There were more than 39 of them.
Well, they were called the Hitchcock Steps, but not because Hitchcock shot on them, just because they were really spooky. Yeah. That was the false part.
So this is one of, I'm sorry, I didn't even consider this being one of you and Tayo's half-truths.
Really, yeah. Really tricky half-truth. Tayo did find something that I didn't know. Joel Schumacher was filming St. Elmo's Fire at Georgetown and attempted to get permission from the Jesuit priest facility at that school to film there, but he was rejected. He reminded the father that The Exorcist had shot on the Georgetown campus, and in that movie, a 13-year-old girl pees on a rug and masturbates with the cross. The father told him, yes, but in that movie, the devil didn't win, which I don't know. That was a fun little tidbit.
Depends on which version of the movie you watch, right?
Yeah.
I guess he was talking about, St. Elmo's Fire was before the director's cut came out, so.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But I like that his take was like, yeah, the God won. That's why you can shoot here.
That's why it's okay. Yeah. Well, there was some energy around the movie that was like, because I also read that the MPA didn't, because this was in the early years of the MPA, the code was officially gone, 10 years prior to this, something like that. And the X rating was getting tossed around a little bit, and there's always concern about getting an X rating, but there wasn't really an issue with this movie because the MPA decided it was important enough to overlook the gory stuff like that. And it was just like, it's a grounded portrayal of good versus evil, I guess. So, you know, we're not going to rate this X. But
also, wait, wasn't all that self-censorship stuff like really to like appease Catholics anyway? So like,
I think, yeah, like, probably.
So like, this is a story where God exists and defeats the devil.
Yeah, no, we're good. Yeah.
The church is willing to overlook any possessed child masturbation. Because,
well, first of all, Clint, you just totally blew a Torf. That was next. I do think it's funny that the MPAA is so skittish about like sexual content. That's like, well, yeah, you can do whatever you want gore wise, but don't show a boob or anything. Like, that's when you get rated X. Okay, true or false? The official body count is 5.
Oh, is this how many people died in
death count
in the movie?
Yeah.
Go with true.
We'll go with false.
What do you think it is? If it's, or you just think it's false?
Isn't it just 3?
No. Name your 3.
I mean, there's the director.
Yeah.
And then both priests.
And then there's the mom. That's 4. She's not murdered. I mean, she's not murdered, but she dies. She's in hell.
Wait, what?
Karras's mother.
Oh, Karras's mom. She died. I'm sorry. So I thought you were talking about. I was like, pretty sure Ellen Burstyn. Which director's cut did you watch?
And then there was the guy that jumped out the window.
Yeah, that was the director.
That was the director?
Yeah.
Shit. All right. Well, anyway, there was at least four. So
at least four. Okay. At least four. I'm still going false.
Okay. Cal, you're true. Clint, you're false.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is false. And yeah, it's actually four. And we just listed them all. Four. There is no more than the four that we listed, basically.
This doesn't include all of the mysterious deaths that were, that occurred during the production. That people thought the set was actually cursed.
Yeah.
Did I just blow another torf?
That was my next torf.
Oh, no. Okay, well, here.
Do you have the same doc, Clint?
No, I'm not.
But that was an easy one, yes. The true or false was that, yes, many people thought it was cursed. And by the end of the film's production, 9 people associated with its making had passed away. Yikes.
Yeah. And also, apparently, Friedkin asked. So there are two actual priests in the movie. There's the priest that Karis meets at the bar. He was like the technical advisor. I think he was the guy that actually gave Blatty all the homework when he was first writing the book. But Friedkin called him to see if he could come exercise the set, and the priest was like, "No. I'm not.
I'm not messing with that." No.
There was a great, in one of the behind the scenes, we watched the same behind the scenes thing. There was this great montage of like everybody from, you know, the art director guy to Max von Sydow to Ellen Burstyn. They were all giving, like, you could see they all kind of came down differently on it. Cause Ellen Burstyn was like, "It was probably cursed. Lots of people died and nobody knows how." And then Sydow was like, "We were making the movie for a year. So yeah, shit happened." Like,
good point though.
The range of like the cynic to the full believer that we see in the movie, like, also happened on set too, which was, I thought was really interesting. But
and I think I mentioned this to you before we started shooting Clint, where like that, like when I was like a kid reading weird stuff on the internet, this is what like really got me into The Exorcist. I was like, ooh, like it's part of like the legend that makes The Exorcist what it is, aside from the movie, like the lore behind it.
Well, I do have one more since I blew two of your twerfs.
Yeah. You gotta fill one in now.
here's one more before we move on. William Peter Blatty, at one point in the 60s, masqueraded as an Arab prince. True or false?
True.
I feel like that it's too specific to be false. It has to be true.
It has to be true. It is actually true.
Because he was like the thing, premise of like the he was on that TV show.
He was on You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
But he had this character that he was like an Arab prince character that was, because he was a comedy writer exclusively before. That's one thing we haven't mentioned is like he was exclusively a comedy writer, and then that work dried up. So he's like, I guess I'll write something scary. But he wrote a book called Which Way to Mecca, Jack? this is apparently some sort of comedy about an Arab prince, and he had this character that he would wander around Hollywood in the 60s pretending to be an Arab prince, to the point where he actually wound up on You Bet Your Life and won like 10 grand from Groucho Marx in the 60s. You can find it on YouTube. It's hilarious. Because like the premise is Groucho Marx has to guess which one of the people is like faking it and is not who they say they are or whatever, and he sees right through him or whatever, and he's like, "Oh, my name's Bill Blatty, and I'm a writer." It was bizarre.
I do like in one of the interviews I was watching, like Blatty does make some kind of like joke about like, "Well, this movie really killed my comedy career," and that just like murdered me for some reason. It's like, imagine that.
And to redeem for your son, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God forever and ever.
Who's your MVP for the movie?
I was going back and forth between Blatty and Friedkin, and I was like, it's going to be a game day decision. I'm going to go Friedkin. Yeah.
Who are you going?
You're going Friedkin, but you like Blatty's cut better.
Well, just some of it.
Just some of it, right.
The a la carte version.
Right. Cal?
Dude, Jason Miller, all the way. Scran, represent.
Scran, Scran's favorite son.
You don't understand. I spent like 20 years of my life living in that town, and like every single person, it's like, oh, you watched? Did you watch The Exorcist? You know the priest is from Scran. Like
I do. Yeah.
Like you guys have to have one of those like hometown heroes that everybody knows who they are, and I mean,
mine was Lyle Lovett.
Yeah. So
Muddy Waters for me.
Oh,
hell
cool.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah, so, I know that's a cool one, right? Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a cool one.
So as far as I'm concerned, the person that won this movie is Jason Miller, because no one in Scranton goes around just being like, yo, Linda Blair, she's awesome in The Exorcist. Everyone's just like, you know, the priest.
Right.
They don't even.
That's fair.
Some people don't even remember his name, like either Karis or Jason Miller. It's just like, you know, the priest.
He's from Scranton. You know, the priest from The Exorcist. This one was a hard one because I feel like there's a lot of people doing really good work that contributed to why this movie is so memorable. But I, just for fun, I'm going to give it to Marcel Vercauteur, the special effects lead on the movie. All the furniture moving, all the beds floating, like we talked about earlier, it was all done so well and it holds up and lent to the realism of the movie in a way that I think was really key. So I'm giving it to Marcel Vercauteur.
Okay,
also, his name, very fun to say.
I also, so I think
my, he's getting it.
My number three was probably going to be Linda Blair too, because my God, that poor girl.
Yeah. I mean, everybody went through it and like did some good work. And I mean, even Dick Smith having to like go reinvent the look of Linda Blair at the last minute. Like everybody's doing. This was a hard movie on a lot of people for a lot of reasons, and everybody came up big, I think. So it was tough. But we are running along once again. So to the point where like we should probably just go ahead and add some time to our schedule for these from now on. But Cal, we got time for one more segment before we get to the ranking.
Who does Nicolas Cage play in The Exorcist? I do. Unlike some of the films we have watched in the last couple episodes, I do think there is room for Nicolas Cage in this movie. I think, I mean, he's very clearly a priest. And the question is, do you go Max von Sydow or do you go Jason Miller?
I'm Father Marin all the way.
Yeah.
I was going to go Kinderman.
Kinderman?
No, that's no fun. Nah. there's not enough to do. I mean the only choice is Marin, right? Because like imagine Nicolas Cage like and the same deal as Max von Sydow, like age him up, you know. Yeah. He's a young man in an older man's makeup and he's quiet and he's not well and he's sort of broken by his experience, and then to see him explode and come to life during the exorcism would be so much fun.
Yeah.
Like I think he would.
That's
he
a really
could
good
do,
point.
He could do Father Marin real justice by I like agree. By that difference.
Yeah, I agree.
Also, I don't know if it's better, but I'm not mad about it.
Also,
I mean,
you know,
you can't beat Sydow, but you can maybe you can equal him.
Yeah, but also like I think he could have done some more interesting stuff in like the early Iraq moments, because like Nicolas Cage could just be silent on film and just be like, what the fuck is this guy doing? You know, just like just sweeping off some like rocks, you know, just doing his Jurassic Park thing. Just being like, you know, I think he could overact that in a way where it seems like it would take up less time.
He's overacting, digging stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe like someone.
I mean, listen, that's an easy one to agree on, I think. I don't want to take anything away from Jason Miller.
Nope.
No. At least not Scranton's, in front of Calibro.
Scranton's favorite son. You can't do it.
All right. Settled. That was easy.
Not. Yeah.
So I had this on my list. Let's get into where it ranks and what Dan's algorithm did here. I had it at number 36 on my list. I really like this movie.
I'm with you, and we're pretty close. It's on my list, and it's at 43. So 43 and
well, there you go.
It's not too far.
Neighbors. Mm-hmm. I'm told Dan did not have it on his list. Cal, did you have it on? You probably didn't have it on yours.
Dude, I'm Omen.
It's your fourth favorite Friedkin movie. So
yeah.
How? Yeah.
It's Scranton's favorite Friedkin movie.
I had it at 36. Alex had it at, it was a 43.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was missing from the other two. Where algorithmically does that end up?
I think so, around
Kyle
the 50
gave
mark.
Us the Halloween, the trick or treat. Do we still need to eat up time? You guys can watch me eat Airheads over here.
We don't need to do that. We were doing that all sound check. We're good.
Okay. So this is it. It is. If you guys had a guess, where it was going to be, what do you think?
36 of 43 and two no shows. It's going to be right in the same neighborhood. High 40s, low 50s.
Yeah.
High 40s, low 50s.
I'll say 50. Yeah. If I had to guess a number, I'll just say 50.
One for Price is Right rules.
Yeah, Price is Right rules. Clint, you take it. It is 42.
42. Yep. Okay.
Not bad.
42.
Top half.
Okay, so yeah, that feels like an algorithm that makes sense.
It's the meaning to me. It's the meaning of life.
It doesn't always.
It's the meaning of life and everything. Exactly.
42.
Okay. Well, did your life and the way that you view The Exorcist change as a result of this conversation? Anybody?
I still love it.
No.
Cal, still like your fourth favorite Friedkin movie?
Yeah, it's still like my fourth favorite Friedkin movie. It's still my second favorite, you know, like possession, devil, demon movie kind of thing, you know. But it is my favorite Scranton adjacent movie.
Sure.
We can all agree on that,
I apologize to both Friedkin and Blatty that we didn't get you away from Team Omen.
For the record, I also really like The Omen.
Yeah, listen, it's very much the Pepsi to the Exorcist's Coke, and like this is like one of the
deep impact to the Exorcist's Armageddon.
Yeah, this is like one of the few times that I'm just like, I really like this Pepsi is way better to me than the Coke. But
all right, well, I need a Coke now. So that's gonna do it for us this week. Thanks again for being here, Alex, Cal. Thanks everybody for listening and watching us talk about a very scary movie. Thanks once again to our TORF specialist, producer Tayo Yakin, technical producer and spider walker, Mariah Franzen, Jamie Parslow, who keeps it below freezing in here, and Dan, who I guarantee you would not help any of us if we were possessed by a demon. So once again, no thanks will be given to Dan. And if you want to hear us without watching our faces talk, and if you want the whole audio only thing, we are in all the usual podcast places, so you can track us down on the platform of your choosing and come back next week. We'll be sticking with a theme of religious artifacts being found in the desert, because we're watching Raiders of the Lost Ark. That'll be next week. So until then, stay safe, be good, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.